so we might as well start. Sounds good.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you to this session, part of this wonderful intellectual celebration we're having at the Boston Book Festival. My name is Bill Keeler. I'm professor of history and international relations at Boston University. It gives me great pleasure to introduce Stephen Kinzer to you. I'm sure that he is known by many of you because of his longtime experience as a New York Times correspondent in a number of foreign countries, and also from the number of books that he's written on a variety of subjects in Central America, Turkey, Rwanda, American intervention in the world. And today, of course, we're here to discuss his latest book, which is just off the presses, and which will be available at the end if any of you are interested in receiving a signed copy of it, on the Dulles Brothers. I had the great opportunity to read this book in manuscript form, and I predicted at the time this would become a very important addition to the literature, and it already has. So what I thought I would do in just a few minutes here is to introduce some themes under the general theme of the 1950s and American foreign policy, and then ask Stephen if he would respond to those themes, and then if he would raise any other themes that he thinks are important. And I know that there are several other themes that are in his book that he will probably want to talk about. But this book begins in the very early period of the Dulles brothers' lives and covers their attendance at the Paris Peace Conference of 1919, when their uncle, the Secretary of State, invited them to come there. And it goes through the 1920s, when they made a lot of money at Sullivan and Cromwell as money makers, I guess you would call them. But the important part of the book, as far as we're concerned here, is when we get around to the 1950s and the Eisenhower administration, and John Foster Dulles becomes the Secretary of State and Allen Dulles becomes the Director of Central Intelligence. So just to get the conversation going, I'd like to ask Stephen to comment on the two, in my view, most important contributions that each one of these brothers makes to American foreign policy during their period in office. And we'll start with Allen, or Ali, as he was affectionately called by his close friends. And that is the use of covert operations to achieve the goals of American foreign policy. There are a number of examples of this that Stephen will probably refer to and does refer to in his books. The second theme that I'd like to introduce is related to the brother, Foster's policy as Secretary of State, and that is this concept of relying on American nuclear weapons delivered in those days by air power to deter the Soviet Union from committing conventional aggression in Europe, the so-called New Look policy that was introduced in the early stages of the Eisenhower administration, immortalized by the famous comment of the Secretary of Defense, Charlie Wilson, getting more bang for the buck, that is, threatening nuclear war in order to prevent war. And both of these are related to, I think, another theme that I'd like to ask Stephen about, he's interested in pursuing it, and that is Eisenhower's desire to reduce defense spending. Instead of paying all of this money to raise huge conscript armies and send hundreds of thousands of GIs to Europe, you rely on covert operations, in and out, actions that can achieve your objectives at very low cost. And then secondly, relying on nuclear weapons to go to the brink of war, but not going over the brink as a way of reducing the defense budget. So with that brief introduction, Stephen, you've got the podium. And anything else you want to talk about with regard to the Dulles brothers?
Thanks very much, Bill. It's great to be here with you. I'm not at the podium, but I'll take it figuratively. It's wonderful to be part of this festival and to be in this building. I actually I wrote a lot of my high school and college term papers in this building. I learned a lot of what I know in this building, and I used to stare, actually, outside at those panels that have all the names of famous authors and thinkers of the past, and I would be marveling at how few of them I actually recognized, and I would try to write one down and bring it in and research that one person. This building means a great deal to me, and it's wonderful to be here in such an environment. I guess people in our business like to think that in addition to preserving and transmitting the body of human knowledge, we also should try to add to it. And that's something like what I'm trying to do in this book. So let me talk a little bit about my book, and then I'm going to address the themes that that Bill has mentioned. I've had one thrill already on this book, and it's alphabetical. I've had too many bad experiences of finding my books in the bookstore in the section called World Affairs, and because they're arranged alphabetically, I'm right next to Kissinger. This is paining me. But this time, it just happened to me the other day. I fell victim, and I typed in The Brothers on Amazon, and sure enough, my book comes up, The Brothers, and the next book right under it is The Brothers Karamazov. Now I'm on Dostoevsky's level instead of Kissinger. Such a much more pleasant place to be. I got interested in the Dulles Brothers because of my interest in the roots of world crises. I spent more than 20 years working for the New York Times. I was always having to write about what's happening right now. I was a newsman, and I was never able to admit during those days that I'm actually not very interested in news. Because I think when you're focusing completely on what's happening today, you're forgetting two questions that I think are actually more important and interesting than what's happening today. The one is, what happened yesterday? How did this event today happen? What brought it about? And the other question is, what's going to happen tomorrow? What's the importance of what just happened? I think there's a tendency to force us to focus on what's going on right now. That way we don't think about these other things like the roots of our crises. Now, when I would arrive in countries with which I was unfamiliar, I often tried to understand why this country is this way. Why is it rich and powerful? Why is it poor and miserable? I had one experience like this when I was in Iran. The first time I was sent to Iran, I was shocked by the difference between the size and the history and the culture of this country on the one hand, and the fact that it's poor and isolated and unhappy and under an undemocratic regime on the other. So I would ask people, why is this? Why don't you have a democracy? And my Iranian new friends would smile indulgently and say, oh, we had a democracy here until you Americans showed up and destroyed it, and we've had a dictatorship here ever since. Well, this was a little bit shocking to me as an American. It doesn't fit my self-image or my image of my country. So I began to research what actually happened in Iran. And I did this with a number of other crises that I covered. When I worked in Rwanda, I was right next door to the Congo. The Congo has been caught in this unbelievably horrific civil war for more than 20 years now, in which we're told millions have died. Well, it turns out the Congo did once have a democratic election in 1960, and a guy named Patrice Lumumba was elected prime minister. But the Americans and the Belgians feared him, and within a few months, he was overthrown and assassinated. I was recently in Guatemala. That's another country that has emerged from a terrible Holocaust in which hundreds of thousands died. You can trace this back to an American intervention in the 1950s. All of these interventions have the Dulles fingerprints on them. So the Dulles brothers are minor characters in all of these operations. But I began to think history requires that they be brought up to their true importance. They were not minor characters. These two extraordinary brothers shaped the world. They had the power to make and break nations, and they did. Probably there wasn't a literate human being on Earth who did not know the name Dulles, and many feared it. But look what's happened today. The Dulles name is almost completely forgotten. When I was working on this book, some of my friends asked me, so what are you writing about? What are you working on now? And I would say, I'm writing a book about Dulles. And they would say, the airport? This is the level to which their image has fallen. And in fact, when I started out writing this book, I went out to see the big bust of John Foster Dulles at Dulles Airport because I saw the YouTube video of President Kennedy inaugurating it, and I find out it's gone. And I finally tracked it down. The bust of Dulles in Dulles Airport is in a closed closet opposite baggage claim number 3. We've airbrushed the Dulles brothers out of our history. And I think maybe part of the reason is that their approach to the world didn't work out well for us. Rather than confront that fact and see if we can draw some lessons from their mistakes, I think maybe it's easier, it's more convenient to pretend that that didn't happen. But when you look around the world, you see that the one big conception about the 1950s that I think most of us share is wrong. And that is the 1950s was essentially a period of peace. Now, with all the documents having been declassified and so much history having been written and so many memoirs having been published, we can see that the United States was waging unending war during the 1950s. We didn't see it because these wars were being waged clandestinely. And even when we knew they were being fought, we didn't realize that we were involved. We were told that these were all domestic conflicts. But the Dulles brothers never finished carrying out one covert operation before they started another. The theater of operations changed from Iran to Guatemala to Vietnam to Indonesia to Egypt to the Congo to Cuba. But it was a constant war. And I think for this reason, once the Dulles brothers are very effective people for us to through whom to examine this history. Because my book is a biography. It takes the Dulles brothers from their earliest childhood to through their death. But I'm trying to do something more than just tell their story. I'm using the story of the Dulles brothers to ask this larger question, why does the United States behave the way that it does in the world? Why is it that whenever there's a conflict or a confrontation or upheaval in Bangladesh or Burundi or Belize or Bhutan or Bolivia, we feel we have to get involved, we have to figure out who we want to get out, who we want to put in, what kind of regime we want? Why is it that we're not able to realize that sometimes there are things in Bolivia that are just up to Bolivia to decide? Why must we always assume that we know more about what's good for the world than the world itself knows? Those were impulses that the Dulles brothers exemplified. So my book, in a sense, is their story. But I also try to look at the factors that influence them, because I think those factors actually influence us. They shape our whole country and our whole foreign policy. The Dulles brothers are us, and we are them. They did not hijack us or do something we didn't want. Maybe that's one reason why we've tried to airbrush them out of our history. Now, let me address the points that my colleague, Professor Keeler, brought up. First of all, the Allen Dulles concept of covert operation. Allen Dulles was fascinated by intelligence from his childhood. You know, these kids were brought up in a remarkable environment. Their grandfather had been Secretary of State. That was before their uncle got to be Secretary of State. And when they were 10 and 12 years old, they were having dinner at the DuPont Circle mansion of their grandfather, and the other dinner guests would be people like William Howard Taft, Andrew Carnegie, Grover Cleveland, Woodrow Wilson. So they were exposed to cabinet members and ambassadors and people at that level from a very young age. After the dinners were over, the two boys would go up to bed, but before going to bed, Allie would write little reports to himself, in which he would list every person that was at the meeting, what they said, and what he really thought about them. This was a kid of 10 years old, future director of an intelligence agency that didn't even exist then. So he already had this bent. But during both world wars, he was an American intelligence operative in Switzerland. He was fascinated by intelligence. And in 1947, he helped co-author the National Security Act that created the CIA. He did something very important in this project, and that is he violated the rule that had been observed by every Western Secret Service up to that time, particularly the British Secret Service, which was always held up as the gold standard in intelligence. And that rule was this. You have to have a firewall, an absolute separation between the people on the one hand who gather and analyze intelligence and on the other hand the people who carry out covert operations. Because if you put those people in the same agency, there's always going to be pressure on the intelligence analysts to come up with an analysis that ends, and so we need a covert operation. And Alan Dulles combined those two. He destroyed that firewall, and he made the CIA the first intelligence agency in the Western world that did it all. And sure enough, what everybody feared did happen. That is, the CIA developed a kind of publish or perish mentality where if you didn't have operations going all the time, you could get fired. You always had to be out there carrying out operations. And I think this restless activism was a great part of Alan Dulles's approach to the world. He had 100% support from President Eisenhower. There used to be this myth of the rogue elephant CIA and the Dulles brothers bamboozling Eisenhower or not telling him what they were doing. This is not true. The historical record is very clear. Eisenhower understood it all. And this brings me into your second question about the new look. That was Eisenhower's defense policy. So you're absolutely right. The new look was based on Eisenhower's desire to save money. It's really remarkable when you read these once private conversations how Eisenhower is very serious about cutting the defense budget. And he makes comments like, if there's some weapon we desperately need, but it's more than our economy can afford, we shouldn't buy it. It's something we would have never imagined a president saying today. So Eisenhower had this policy called the New Look. And it had two pieces. Number one, cut the size of the standing army to save money, and number two, build up the nuclear deterrent. Cheaper and maybe also scarier. But what we didn't know is that the new look was not composed of two pillars, it was actually composed of three. It was smaller army, nuclear deterrent, and covert action. Eisenhower never explained why he was such a supporter of covert action because he never admitted that he was. In those days, he didn't do that. But I think we can say that, first of all, we know now that covert action played a big role in winning World War II. Nobody knew that at the time, but Eisenhower would certainly have known it, so he would have had a great appreciation for what covert action can do. And secondly, I think he would have seen covert action as a peace project, as you mentioned. This is a guy that had to send thousands of people off to die. This must have weighed heavily on him. And now he finds a way he can overthrow a government where just a few dozen or a few hundred people die and then none of them are Americans. So this sounds great. And finally, I would just add this. One reason why the Dulles brothers and Eisenhower were so thrilled by the idea of covert action and overthrowing foreign governments is that they had no concept of what we would today call blowback. They never imagined that decades or generations later these apparently successful operations would actually have not only terrible results for the target country, but would also palpably reduce American security in the world.
Well, you raised all sorts of questions, and let me throw a slightly different one at you to see what your response would be to this, Stephen. What about the personal elements between these two brothers? I can't imagine two more different personalities than those two brothers. Talk a little bit about their personal lives and how that may have affected, if it did, their policies.
It's really a remarkable story, and you'd need to be a psychologist to understand this better than I do, but I can tell you what I do understand, or what we know. So John Foster Dulles and Alan Dulles grew up very intimately. They had the same experiences, and they came to view the world exactly the same way. Politically and ideologically, they were peas in a pod. Just one wink and a nod between them, a government would fall. They never had to consult anybody else. But in their personalities, they were polar opposites. So John Foster Dulles was sour, arrogant, self-righteous, prude. I read somewhere, even his friends don't like him. He had a whole series of very awkward social habits, which I list in one of my favorite paragraphs in the book. One of them was that he used to like to, he had this favorite drink, rye whiskey, Old Overholt. And he liked to stir it with his finger at the dinner table and then suck the whiskey. So I told my wife, on the day we get the first copy of the book, we're going out to a bar, and I'm ordering Old Overholt, and I'm going to do it with my finger. And she has the picture with the bar, with the bottle and everything at Eastern Standard with me with the finger in my mouth. I'm not putting that one on my website. So Alan Dulles was exactly the opposite. Alan was a sparkling conversationalist and a party-goer. Was like somebody out of the Great Gatsby with an endless supply of stories, and he had 100 mistresses from Claire Booth Luce to the Queen of Greece. I think this was very important for the CIA in the 50s for this reason. Alan Dulles was not only the head of the invisible government, he was also the ambassador of the invisible government to the visible government. So when all the Georgetown set and all the nice folks in Washington would welcome Alan and click glasses with him at their dinner parties, I think they would come away feeling, well, of course, we don't know what the CIA does, but if it's being run by such a wonderful guy, we might as well support it. It can't be anything very bad.
When I was reading his book in galley form, the Petraeus scandal broke, and I immediately sent Stephen an email. What would Alan Dulles have to say about this?
You know,
one extramarital affair?
It brings up one fantasy. You know, I sometimes wonder, so why didn't the Russians find out that Alan Dulles had 100 affairs and try to blackmail him and get him to do what they wanted, and, you know, like they would today? I mean, today, even a low-ranking CIA agent would never get away with what Alan Dulles did. So I don't know the answer to that, but here's my fantasy, that actually the Russians did find out, and they did blackmail him, and they told him, we're going to ruin your career unless you send the CIA out on operations that will devastate American security for generations. And he did that. Maybe that's the explanation.
Let me raise a subject that is not as well known, I think, as the ones we've mentioned, but perhaps worth discussing, and that is the behavior and the policy of Foster during the Suez Crisis of 1956. And we were chatting before this meeting, and I said, well, was there anything good that the Dulles brothers did? And I said, how about the Suez Crisis? John Foster Dulles, in effect, intervenes with Eisenhower's full support to slap down the British and the French and the Israelis who are trying to overthrow Nasser. What do you think? Is that a plus for them?
I think the Suez incident is really interesting. So it happened at the end of 1956. And we were taken by surprise.
Yeah.
Suddenly the French and the British and the Israelis have invaded Egypt, and we were very upset, I think, for a couple of reasons. The Dulles brothers, I think, and Eisenhower did react in a good way, that they reacted against the invasion, which they saw as simply a last gasp of imperialism, which it was. But they had their own motives. They wanted the French and the British out of the Middle East so that we could go in. And think that their intervention there had a very particular pro-American motive. But there was another thing that really upset I think that both of the Dulles brothers about the Suez Crisis, and this became clear within days after the invasion, and it was this. They had the idea, the Dulles brothers, that they were going to overthrow Nasser. Nasser was a guy they hated because he was a neutralist. He didn't want to take sides in the Moscow-Washington conflict, just like Sukarno in Indonesia or Lumumba in the Congo or Nehru in India. We hated neutralism, and in fact, we have a quote from Alan Dulles when he's in Cairo. He's meeting with his CIA station chief there and talking about Colonel Nasser, who was then in power. And he said to the station chief, if that colonel of yours pushes us too far, we'll break him in half. This is how the chief of the U.S. Intelligence Service talks about the head of state of a foreign nation. Now, we were, and Alan Dulles was totally focused on the idea of trying to overthrow Nasser. But once the Suez Crisis happened, Nasser became a hero of epic proportions, not just in Egypt, but in the whole Middle East. Then there was no hope to overthrow him. You couldn't find any element that would help. And so, lamentably, the Dulles brothers decided they'd move their theater of operations to Indonesia, and maybe we'll start a civil war over there and try to overthrow Sukarno instead. Mm-hmm. So if there was another loser from the Suez Crisis besides the Israelis and the French and the British, it might have been Sukarno, since he's the one that then got the ire of the Dulles brothers, and a civil war was fomented in Indonesia that might, under other circumstances, have been fomented in Egypt.
Mm-hmm. So after Foster dies in 1959, Allen is still in power. President Kennedy enters the White House, inheriting the Bay of Pigs project. Could you say a few words about Allen Dulles' role in that, compare it with Richard Bissell and any of the other characters? Does he deserve the blame that he got for that?
John Foster Dulles, as you say, died while Eisenhower was still president. And actually, he didn't live to see his reputation decline. When he died, the nation was grief-stricken, and the funeral was carried on live television. It was a big deal. But fate was not so kind to Allen Dulles. Only 2 days after President Kennedy was elected, he held his first news conference. And in the first sentence of his first news conference, he said he was reappointing Allen Dulles as director of the CIA. Allen Dulles was then already involved in a project to get rid of Fidel Castro. And that was by invading, sending a group of exiles to invade at the Bay of Pigs. So Kennedy had signed on to this project after Allen Dulles warned him that if he didn't, we would have what Allen called a serious disposal problem, by which he meant you've got 1,500 Cuban exiles training at a camp already in Guatemala. If we go to them and say, it's off, they're all going to go home to Miami, and the narrative forever is going to be the United States was just about to get rid of Fidel Castro, but Kennedy lost his nerve, and it didn't happen. So Kennedy went along with the plan. Allen assured him it would work, although many changes were made along the way that guaranteed that it wouldn't work. The two chief operations officers for the Bay of Pigs invasion came to their boss 8 days before and told him it would result in a terrible disaster. Don't do it. But that didn't have any effect. Afterward, Kennedy was furious. How could I have been so stupid? He cried out. And he said he wanted to smash the CIA into a million smithereens. Now, let me talk a little bit about Allen Dulles' role, because I find in the research for this book, and I write about this, I think, for the first time from this point of view, a different take on the Bay of Pigs invasion. It's all true that it was the CIA's long-term idea that even though the plan was going to fail, they thought that at the last moment when they brought it to Kennedy and the thing was in the middle and they told him it's going to fail, that Kennedy would say, oh, well, okay, we've got to carry it through now, which is what Eisenhower had done in the past. But Kennedy didn't do that. He said to them, I told you we're not sending in U.S. Air Force planes. And they said, yes, but now look at the situation. And Kennedy said, you're not listening to me. I don't care about the situation. I'm not sending U.S. planes. So they didn't expect that. But there's another aspect to this operation. When Allen Dulles began planning, or he was essentially ordered by Eisenhower, find me a way to get rid of Castro. So the idea emerges of an exile invasion. The first thing that Allen Dulles did was turn the operation over to his number two, Richard Bissell. He had never done this before. And this was one of the biggest CIA operations ever. Allen Dulles just sat quietly at the meetings in the White House and other places when the plan was being discussed. When Bissell briefed the Joint Chiefs of Staff on what they were going to do, Allen Dulles didn't even show up at the meeting. He wasn't even in Washington on the day of the invasion. He arrived back at Baltimore Airport at midnight, and his aide picked him up. And he said, so how are things going in Cuba? And the guy said, not very well, sir. Oh, is that so? Says Allen. Then they drive home, and Allen starts talking about baseball and telling stories, and the aide later described this evening as unreal. Later on, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee held a closed hearing, and we now have the minutes. And several of the key planners all come back to this idea that, As Admiral Arleigh Burke said, I blame Allen for not being there. He would sit and puff on his pipe and never say a word. When those two guys who were the chief operations officers decided that the Bay of Pigs invasion was going to result in a terrible disaster, they went to see Bissell, and they told him that. When he said, we're going ahead with it anyway, under other circumstances, they might have said, we're going to the boss. We're going to Allen. But they would have never thought of going to Allen because Allen had completely disconnected himself from the plot. He had never done this before. Later on, we have in the future weeks a report from Robert Kennedy about how he was buried his head in his hands. Dulles was walking around with his head in his hands, and he seemed totally beaten down. Within a few years, Alan Dulles was found wandering on the streets of Georgetown, unable to find his way home. The young niece who took care of him later wrote about this moment and said, I think he was suffering from what we would today call Alzheimer's. I wonder if there's a connection between the fact that Alan Dulles, for the first time in his life, carried out a major operation and didn't care about it, didn't show up at meetings, wasn't interested, never wanted to know the details, and on the other hand, that very soon afterwards, he seemed to be developing these symptoms of extreme inattention. Is there a possibility that maybe the Bay of Pigs fiasco was in part the result of the beginnings of Alan's dementia? So it's an interesting question that I don't think there's an answer to, but when you're thinking about the hidden sources of global crises, it's a nice one to think about.
Well, I had another question for you, but I want to follow that up. If Alan Dulles was suffering from some serious mental issues and maybe dementia as early as 1961, why does LBJ name him to the Warren Commission to determine who was responsible for the assassination?
This is a fascinating story. So it's true that Alan Dulles was fired by Kennedy in 1961 after the fiasco at the Bay of Pigs. 2 years later, Kennedy was assassinated, and Johnson put Alan Dulles on the Warren Commission to find out who did it. Now, Johnson did this for a very specific reason. He knew, Johnson knew, he's one of the few people who knew, that the CIA had been carrying out murder, assassination plots in the Caribbean. He has a quote, a famous quote to another senator where he says, we were running a goddamn murder inc. in the Caribbean. So he wanted to be, Johnson was totally focused on the goal that the Warren Commission should conclude it was a lone assassin acting by himself. If suddenly the Warren Commission starts finding out that the CIA has been trying to assassinate leaders in the Caribbean, maybe they'll start investigating whole other directions, and this is going to confuse the whole issue. Johnson wanted a quick resolution. So he put Alan on the Warren Commission exactly to protect the CIA secrets. And it worked. The Warren Commission never found out that the CIA, for example, had tried several times to assassinate Castro, and Kennedy had been behind all this. Alan had two functions on the Warren Commission. Number one, he briefed the other members of the Warren Commission on how to question the CIA witnesses that came before them. And the other thing he did was he would coach the CIA witnesses on what questions to expect and how to answer them. So his service on the Warren Commission was a huge success if you measure it by according to the purpose for which he was placed there.
Yeah. Let me ask you a question about the economic interests of these two brothers. And two that immediately come to mind are John Foster Dulles's involvement in Sullivan and Cromwell, particularly in Germany in the early 1930s. And in your book, you point out that when after Hitler comes to power, there's a debate within this law firm about whether they should continue to have the firm's representation in Berlin, and John Foster Dulles tries to preserve that, and he's overruled. So what about this economic interest that he has, and how does it impinge, if at all, on his attitude toward foreign policy? And then secondly, getting up to the overthrow of Arbenz in Guatemala in 1953, the allegation has been made that since both Dulles brothers had been involved with the United Fruit Company, land had been confiscated by the government, that they were motivated not only by concern about communism in Guatemala, but concern about their friends in United Fruit.
This is a huge subject, but you're absolutely right. I think maybe there were two giant factors that shaped the Dulles brothers' consciousness and their view of the world. The first was Calvinist Presbyterianism, and missionary Calvinism in particular. They grew up in a long line of missionaries and preachers, and they were imbued with this religious view that there's good and evil in the world. Not as many cultures are taught that we're all some good and some evil, depending on circumstances. So Christians do not have the right to stay home and hope that good triumphs. You have to go out in the world and be sure it triumphs. From that, it's a very short step over to believing in politics what you believe about religion, that there's good regimes and bad regimes, and the good ones have to go out and crush the bad ones. So I think that Calvinist missionary ethos permeated their view of the world. The second big factor was exactly their decades of work for this uniquely powerful law firm in Wall Street, Sullivan and Cromwell. This was not a normal law firm. If you really needed to be represented in court or had a contract you needed drawn up, they could do that, but that's not their specialty. Their specialty was pressuring small countries to do what big American companies wanted them to do. And the Dulles brothers had lots of practice at Sullivan and Cromwell in doing that. All the way back in 1917, when John Foster Dulles was just a young associate, he was presented with the problem that came up in Cuba. The Liberal Party, which wanted to limit the role of American corporations in Cuba, had won the election. The American corporations that had their fortunes in Cuba were in a panic. They were all represented by Sullivan and Cromwell. They went to Sullivan and Cromwell and said, you can't let the liberals take power. So an effort was made to keep them out of power, and the liberals rose up. John Foster Dulles took the train to Washington. He met with the Secretary of State, otherwise known as Uncle Bert. He told Uncle Bert to send two warships to Cuba. Two warships were sent the next day. 6,000 Marines debarked. They occupied Cuba for the next several years. The liberal rebellion was crushed, and the companies that had hired United Fruit to protect them got what they paid for. That's what the Dulles brothers spent their entire legal career doing. Now, they were spectacularly successful in protecting the rights of their clients. And that's how John Foster Dulles became the highest paid lawyer in the United States. But in 1951, they suffered two terrible blows to which they were totally unaccustomed. The first one came from Iran. The democratically elected government of Mohammad Mossadegh, with a full vote of the parliament in Iran, voted to nationalize the Iranian oil industry, which was owned by one single company, the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company, and the bank for that company, its financial agent, was something called the Schroeder Bank, big international bank that had Sullivan and Cromwell as a client. And in fact, Alan Dulles was on the board of the Schroeder Bank. So he had to go to the other Schroeder Bank directors and say, we failed you in Iran. You hired us to be sure your investments in Iran would be safe, and they're not safe. You lost them. They were not used to doing that, and they never forgot that. Very soon afterward, the government of Guatemala, through a vote of its Congress, decided to carry out a land reform program that affected the interests of United Fruit, one of the oldest and most powerful Sullivan and Cromwell clients. Both Dulles brothers had represented United Fruit. Both had gone to Guatemala. Both owned large blocks of shares in United Fruit. And they had to go back to the United Fruit directors and say, we failed you. We've been protecting your interests all over the world for 50 years. But we couldn't protect you in Guatemala. They never forgot this. They couldn't do anything about it when they were private lawyers. But as soon as they got into the position of power in the beginning of 1953, they started working on those two guys. They didn't even wait for Eisenhower to be inaugurated before they started hatching the plot against Mossadegh in Iran that led to the end of democracy in that country. That was carried out within their first year in office. And within a year after that, they had already also gotten rid of the democratic government in Iran.
In Guatemala.
In the future years, they went off against other targets who developed as their enemies over the period of years. But these were two enemies, two monsters they set out against, Mossadegh in Iran and Arbenz in Guatemala, against whom I think they had deep grudges from their days in the law firm. And they saw overthrowing those guys as kind of unfinished business left over from Sullivan and Cromwell days.
Okay. I'm keeping my eye on the clock, and I think we have room for one more question from me, and then we're going to turn the questions over to you in the audience. And my question has to do with John Foster Dulles' rhetoric during the 1952 presidential campaign, when he's the Republican spokesman for foreign policy, and he talks about the need to liberate Eastern Europe and roll back communism to the Russian frontier and so forth. And then when he comes to power, there are two opportunities to bring that about. One is in 1953, after Eisenhower comes into the White House, when there's an uprising in East Germany. And then again in 1956, when there is an uprising in Hungary. And in both cases, the United States does not try to liberate those countries or roll back communism. What's the explanation for the contradiction there?
John Foster Dulles was the chief foreign policy advisor to Eisenhower in the 1952 presidential campaign. He wrote a lot of articles of his own, and he wrote the Republican platform on foreign policy. His central theme, exactly as you say, was containment policy is terrible. The containment policy of Truman and Acheson was we accept communism where it is, and we're just going to make sure it doesn't spread. This is immoral, says Dulles. We are going to have a liberation policy. The idea was to roll back communism. Now, immediately upon taking office, and this is the unanimous consensus of historians, the Dulles brothers simply adopted the containment policy of Truman and Acheson. They didn't change anything. However, they continued to use the rhetoric of liberation. Everybody in Washington knew this was just rhetoric when Foster Dulles would get up and say, the peoples of the captive nations will rise up and they'll throw off their chains. We all understood it. Everyone in Washington realized that the United States was not going to invade the Soviet Union. We were not going to bomb China. But it sounded good. There might not have been much harm in that, except for kind of deluding the American people. But it had a terrible effect because not everybody understood that this was just a joke. The people in Eastern Europe took this seriously, first in East Germany and then in Hungary. In particular, in Hungary, they were fomented by Radio Free Europe, which was a CIA project, and by agents provocateurs inside Hungary, urging people to rise up. And I think they rose up with a real belief in what Foster Dulles was saying. As a matter of fact, the chief CIA operative in charge of fomenting trouble in Hungary, Frank Wisner, not only immediately cabled back in jubilation to Washington, the revolution started, we're all set, but he had actually written a statement for Eisenhower to read explaining why we're sending U.S. troops into Hungary. And they sent him back a note saying, you must be crazy. We're not doing that. Forget it. And this devastated Frank Wisner, who I think really also had believed the rhetoric. And he felt quite personally responsible, I think, for sending these people off to die and for the crushing of this country's democratic rebellion. And I think it helps his slide down into madness and ultimate suicide. It's a little bit different from the James Bond books that Alan Dulles used to like, where there's never any long-term effect from our interventions. Their story tells us something real, although they were living in a little bit of a fantasy world.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, it is now up to you. We have, I'm following the timeline that I was given here, and we have about 20 minutes, so I'd just like to ask if anyone has any questions or comments, and please speak loudly so that, we have a microphone for you.
Pick one.
Right here with the blue jacket.
As I'm sure you're aware, we are in the city of Tip O'Neill, who said, very wise man he was, said, money is lifeblood of politics. And my question is about the Nazi era and how much trade was done by American companies with what Nazi companies, and what was the position of United States and the Dulles brothers about the Munich situation. A very intelligent person, Aldous Huxley, said he supported Chamberlain, said that if there is war confrontation in support of Czechoslovakia, 5 million people may die. In effect, 50 to 60 million died. What was United States policy about Munich, and what was the role, if any, of the American companies that did business with Nazis?
Well, I appreciate your quote from Tip O'Neill. It brings to mind another similar quote from Jesse Unruh, the famous California politician, who once said, there are only two things important in politics. Number one, first one is money, and I can't remember what the other one is. I can't go into detail about the Munich situation, in which I don't think the Dulles brothers were directly involved, but I can certainly tell you about their involvement with the Nazis. John Foster Dulles was a great admirer of the Hitler regime all through the 1930s. At that point, because of his work at the Paris Peace Conference after World War I, he was a master of these very intricate systems by which international debts and reparations were being paid. He became the number one broker in the United States for bonds by German companies and German municipalities. So he sold in the United States during the 1930s $900 million, which is, you can imagine how many billions now, worth of bonds to finance German corporations and German municipalities during the period when Hitler was in power. He did more than anyone in the United States and maybe in the world to attract foreign financing into Germany during the period of the Hitler regime. And I'll just go back to one other story to which my colleague, Professor Keeler, referred. There was a growing concern in the 1930s at the law firm, at Sullivan and Cromwell, about all their German clients. They had a big office in Berlin and a subsidiary in Frankfurt, and their clients kept coming to them and saying, how can we avoid the law? They didn't know what to do. They decided not to. Foster Dulles said, if we have Jewish clients and it's a problem, just don't see them anymore. So the firm became concerned about their position in Germany. And Alan Dulles came back from a visit in 1934 with the shocking suggestion that we close the office. Alan Dulles had actually gotten to meet Hitler. And John Foster Dulles always envied him for this, for his whole life. And Hitler actually said something very clever to Alan Dulles. He must have been very well briefed. Alan Dulles went to see him in 1934 and said, he asked about the violence on the streets. I happened to notice a little detail of thugs going around in uniform and beating up Jews and breaking their shop windows. And Hitler, who must have been very aware of who Alan Dulles was, said, all we're doing is trying to protect the millions of dollars in foreign investment that's here in Germany. That was the end of that conversation. So the law firm finally had a climactic meeting of the board in New York in which they had to decide, are we going to close the office in Germany or not? Foster Dulles began the meeting. He was the managing partner with an impassioned argument why we should keep the office open, but nobody else supported him. And the vote was finally taken to close the Sullivan and Cromwell office in Germany. I have at least two accounts that Foster Dulles wept after this decision was reached, and I have no account of him ever weeping at any other decision in his life. And just as a footnote, this decision was made in 1935. Foster Dulles then backdated it to 1934 to make it seem like he had closed the office a year earlier. Yeah, right behind him there.
Can you tell us whether WikiLeaks helps you in your research? And also, has the CIA ever done anything right?
On WikiLeaks, you know, I'm sort of torn between my security hat and my journalist hat. In the end, I think I favor it. I like what WikiLeaks has done. I think it's positive. And I would say, I do believe there are certain things that should never be made public, but I don't think what the WikiLeaks has made public falls into that category. And I would argue that the abuses that the WikiLeaks revelations have made public are probably greater than the abuse of making them public. So I'm going to have to put myself down on the list for a potential drone strike. But yeah, I think I can't say anything good about Putin until the Pussy Riot girls are out, but that Snowden is there. I think it's okay. It doesn't bother me. Now, your other question was about ever done anything good. Okay, I'm going to answer you that. It's a kind of a semi-serious question, but I'm going to tell you something very serious that I came away from my research on this book understanding, and that was that the image of Alan Dulles as the super spy master is actually a big fake, because every single operation that he carried out either failed or almost failed. I mean, both of the big so-called early successes against Arbenz in Guatemala and Mossadegh in Iran actually failed, and then suddenly something was done at the end and they patched it together, and then if the other guy hadn't lost his nerve, it might not have happened. So this myth was created. But actually, Alan Dulles, the great stage master and puppeteer of the world, is almost like that Wizard of Oz figure. Don't look behind the machine, and you'll see there's just this guy who can't even find his office in the morning. So I think he created a kind of a fictional mythos for himself, and he was such a sparkling character that people believed it. But when you look back, he was, neither of the brothers was really a thoughtful figure or an innovative or a visionary figure. I love that quote that Harold Macmillan, the British Prime Minister, said about Dulles once, John Foster Dulles. His speech was slow, but it easily kept pace with his thoughts. Okay, thank you. Right in the front. Yeah, great.
Of your the sources for your book, which ones were documents that were declassified, and people knowing you, whether if you approach people from their family, whether that was a closed door, I mean, which doors open, which door closed with your name, I don't know.
So the question was about the sources for the book and how I wrote it. First of all, I was told at the very beginning, which turned out to be true, if you want to find out what a black hole is, try to get information from either Sullivan and Cromwell or United Fruit. It's a complete vacuum, and that's true. There's nothing. Nothing ever comes out of those holes. Nonetheless, I found some very interesting sources. I'm a little too late to have met colleagues. I know people that were much younger, but like as a long interview with a CIA officer that I conducted who came in under Alan Dulles and was shaped by the Alan Dulles ethos, but of a different generation. And this guy is, of course, long retired now. However, I did find a tremendous load in the Dulles papers, which are deposited at Princeton University. I found so many things in there that nobody has ever found or seen or been able to understand. Just for an example, there are not only papers in there, but there's all kinds of stuff. Just everything that they had around is just dumped in there in boxes. So I went through everything. I'll just give you one little example. I find some envelopes of black and white travel snapshots. Those of you that are over a certain age will remember what travel snapshots used to look like. And they're all pictures of the Dulles' house, and they're traveling, and regular tourist pictures. Suddenly, I see a picture of Clover Dulles, that's the wife of Alan, posing in front of a Mayan stela, which I, having been in Guatemala, can identify as the big stela that's right outside the Bananera plantation of the United Fruit Company. So there she is, obviously accompanied by her husband, although he doesn't show up in the pictures. CIA directors didn't do that. But it's clear that, obviously, Alan was there. We know that now from other sources. Then we also see pictures of Clover Dulles, the wife, all over Guatemala, going to little marketplaces and going to villages. She obviously got quite taken by Guatemalan culture. And then, in another envelope, I found some photos of the Alan Dulles weekend house in Long Island. So from the outside, it looks like every other house on the North Shore of Long Island. But there's also pictures inside. And I see to my astonishment that in the living room, all the walls are covered by Guatemalan fabrics. And the mantelpiece has little Guatemalan figurines on it. So it means that while Alan Dulles was sitting around on the weekends plotting to destroy Guatemala and set it onto this spiral down into what came to became this horrible civil war, he was surrounded by Guatemalan artifacts. It shows you maybe there's something in the human psyche that leads us first to become fascinated with another people, then to want to help them, then to want to guide them, and when they resist us, finally to make them the objects of our coercion. So no foreign country was as big a physical presence in the weekend life of Alan Dulles than Guatemala. And had I not been sitting in the Dulles Library day after day flipping through envelopes, neither I nor anyone else would have found that out. And that becomes the opening scene, by the way, of my chapter about the overthrow of the government of Guatemala in this new book.
It seems that nothing has really changed when you look at why we're in Iraq and Afghanistan. While you've been talking, it seems that nothing has changed.
I certainly can sympathize with that point of view. The idea of how the United States should approach the world that the Dulles brothers embodied has been quite durable. It lasted through all the Cold War and beyond. It is based in part on this idea that there's evil out there and we have to go get them. We always hear about the evildoers and we have to go out and smash them down. And either you're with us or you're with the terrorists. You just changed the word. In those days it was you're with us or you're with the communists. So some of those impulses are still there. But I'm interested to note this. Yes, just within the last few weeks, we've had two interesting episodes. The first was President Obama wanted to bomb Syria. But most Americans and most members of Congress seem to be against it, and it didn't happen. This is the first time I can remember ever in my lifetime that the President of the United States wanted to bomb a country and the American people didn't like it. They thought it was a bad idea. I've never heard of this before. Then, soon thereafter, the President of the United States spoke with the President of Iran on the phone. This was a total rejection of the Dulles principle: never talk, never negotiate, and ultimately you'll get what you want. So it makes me wonder, did the Dulles era just end? Like last month? These weeks? Is it now ending?
Perfect timing for your book.
I'm a little bit skeptical. Let's face it, as you pointed out, we got a couple of big punches right in the face in Iraq and Afghanistan. Maybe we're a little groggy, and as soon as we get the smelling salts, we'll be back in the ring punching again. So maybe it was just a little pendulum swing. But maybe not. Maybe we are taking a somewhat different approach to the world, and we're listening to some guy in the street who says, I don't have a job, and you're telling me that I should focus on bombing Syria. I'm missing something. Why? If that becomes the mentality when we begin to question whether we really can dominate the world anymore and whether we really know everything about what's best for the world, then we will have broken with the Dulles paradigm.
The organizers of this event provided me with a timeline, and it says, 25 minutes after, last question. Last question.
Thank you very much. I'd like to ask, to what extent do you find that other intelligence agencies within the Dulles era, both in the Western world and in the Soviet republics, to what extent do they adapt and change their tactics in response to what Dulles is doing? Do you find them starting to do the same thing, also discarding their firewalls, adapting a more active interventionist posture, or do they start trying to differentiate themselves, acting a lot differently?
I don't think, I certainly know that no Western agencies ever copied what the Dulles brothers did. In fact, failures of the CIA later on and this compulsive activism that characterized the Dulles brothers were seen as evidence that breaking down this firewall was a big mistake. Now, just to talk about their errors in judgment as a kind of a summary, I would say that they made three big errors. One I referred to at the beginning. They had no concept of blowback. They never figured out that these operations would have terrible effects long time into the future. And for this one, maybe I can excuse them a little bit, because let's face it, they couldn't know from experience that covert actions have terrible effects 50 years later, because 50 years earlier we hadn't had any covert operations. But we know that now, so let's try to learn from that. The second big misjudgment that the Dulles brothers made was that they never explored peace feelers from the Soviet Union in the period after Stalin died. At the end of 1953, the French and the British and Americans had a summit in Bermuda. And the new Soviet leader, Malenkov, had sent out a peace feeler. Specifically, he wanted a summit with the big three and him. So U.S., France, Britain, and Soviet Union, to see if they could manage their Cold War competition. Churchill was for it. The French were for it. But Foster Dulles was totally against it. He felt that if you just sat down with the Soviets, you'd destroy the whole Cold War paradigm, which said that these people are savages and they only want to kill us. They cannot have any forthright ideas. There's no point in dialogue with them. You destroy that when you negotiate. So that was his second misjudgment. And I think the third misjudgment was that the Dulles brothers completely misunderstood the nature of third world nationalism. They saw neutralism and neutralist leaders and anti-colonialism and nationalism in Africa and Asia and Latin America as all part of a Kremlin plot. They saw this as a very diabolical way that the Soviets were planting these leaders like Sukarno and Nasser and Arbenz and Mossadegh in power to ease the transition to communism. So we turned them into enemies. You had hundreds of millions of people around the world looking for their place in this turbulent new post-war order. And all we did was approach them with this rhetoric, like we're doing now, of evildoers and red lines and all options on the table. I hope we've learned a little from that. We'll step back and realize that It's time to put that Dulles bust back where it belongs, in the center of Dulles Airport, so we can confront and understand the legacy of these brothers and maybe learn something from it. Thank you.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank you for your presence. I especially want to thank my old friend and colleague, Stephen Kinzer. And after this event, in the back there, if you're interested, Stephen will be signing his book. Thank you again.